Today on Against the Grain, what role can shame play in politics? If I'm ashamed of something I've done or something I am, is that shame a purely private phenomenon, or can it be harnessed to a political project? I'm CS. The political theorist Manu Samnotra talks about Hannah Arendt's perspective on shame and about his own coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Feeling shame is no fun. If I'm ashamed of something, I'm not feeling good. I'm not doing or being anything productive. Or am I? Could shame, in fact, be generative of something? And could that something be political in nature? Is there, in short, a political valence to shame? Can shame spur us or point the way toward political consciousness and even action? In his new book, Worldly Shame, Ethos in Action, Manu Samnotra draws on the work of Hannah Arendt to examine the political uses of shame. Manu Samnotra is assistant professor of political theory in the School of Interdisciplinary Global Studies at the University of South Florida. When he joined me to talk about both his book and an article he wrote called Sensitive to Shame, Hannah Arendt on Becoming Worldly, he began with these remarks about Hannah Arendt's life and legacy.
So Hannah Arendt is one of the most important political thinkers of the 20th century. Certainly her experiences, in a way, put her at the vanguard of the experiences that have shaped the lives of so many across the 20th and now the 21st centuries. She was born in Germany, and she was, by all accounts, a brilliant student. She studied philosophy under Martin Heidegger and Karl Jaspers, but ultimately decided to leave philosophy when the Nazis came to power and she discovered so many of her erstwhile friends and teachers, not Jaspers, sort of join up with the Nazis. She escapes Germany. She's a Jewish woman. She escapes Germany, lives in France for a while, helps refugees make their way to Palestine. And once the Germans invade France, she manages to escape France and ends up in the United States. Some of her most important texts, her earliest text in this case, the one that made her quite famous in the United States and perhaps now the world over, especially with the election of 2016 on Amazon, is her book, The Origins of Totalitarianism, where she traces across sort of the 19th and 20th century the forces that, as she says, crystallized into the rise of totalitarianism. In her case, political anti-Semitism and imperialism, both crystallized or developed tendencies that crystallized into totalitarianism. From a political theory perspective, her most important text is generally considered to be The Human Condition. And very briefly, according to Arendt, the history of philosophy has misunderstood what political action is. It has almost always used categories drawn from the experience of thinking to describe the experience of action. Or it has misunderstood what action is by subsuming the experience of political action, the freedom we experience when we act into a community of our equals. Philosophy has substituted that experience for the experience of laboring or the experience of producing works of art. And what she tries to do in this text is to recover an element of political action, which she calls political action, from these other tendencies that have sort of hidden away or obscured the uniqueness of this experience. From a general lay perspective, Hannah Arendt is most famous for her book, Eichmann in Jerusalem, which she originally wrote as a series of articles for the New Yorker magazine. She went to Jerusalem to observe and report on the trial of Adolf Eichmann, who was a high-ranking Nazi functionary. I think Arendt went there thinking that she would see someone who was not literally, but about as close as human beings can literally get to a demonic person, almost with horns and, sort of coming out from his head. Instead, she finds this unprepossessing bureaucrat who all he wanted to do his entire life was rise in the ranks of the Nazi hierarchy and be appreciated by his superior officers. And so instead of discovering what she had been taught and what she herself thought for a long time was a radical evil, an evil that has no end, that is beyond our comprehension, she instead finds something that's utterly banal. But for that reason, no less dangerous, but in fact even more dangerous than radical evil, because unlike radical evil, banal evil, the evil that Adolf Eichmann represented, which I'll come to in a moment, it was like a fungus that can spread everywhere and destroy everything. And what she discovered in Eichmann, his fundamental flaw, was his inability to think, his unwillingness to think in anything other than catchphrases and simple aphorisms that he had perfected, he had learned from his superior officers that would, he thought, help him rise in the Nazi hierarchy. So if the absence of thinking represented by Eichmann was one of the major flaws that allowed him to do these things that he did, then it fell on Arendt to try to understand how thinking may have actually helped Eichmann. And so she goes about trying to answer this question in her last book, The Life of the Mind, which is sort of the companion piece, in a way, to The Human Condition. The Human Condition is about the active life, what she calls the vita activa. The Life of the Mind is about the vita contemplativa. And so the vita contemplativa, the life of the mind, Arendt divides into three sections: thinking, willing, and judging. She didn't live to write the third volume in this book. She died in 1975, just as she was starting work on it. But subsequent to that, her reflections along the way, her lecture notes on Kant's theory of judgment, have provided political theorists with enough raw material for thinking about how we might avoid the excesses of the 20th century, how we might develop a capacity to judge. And by judgment, I don't mean judge someone for the clothes they're wearing or judge someone for the color of their skin, but use judgment as we would as an aesthetic experience to figure out what is happening. So for example, just to put a final point on this, we are every day faced with experiences that have no precedent. You viewers have heard this, CS, along the way for the last few years, that we are living through unprecedented times. What that really means is, if in fact that assessment is correct, what that really means is that there is no rule, there is no historical precedent by which we can judge whether what we are seeing before us is a good or bad thing. In such cases, when there is no specific lesson that we can draw from what we are witnessing, it falls on our capacity to judge, to try and figure out what we are seeing, whether it's good or bad. And that capacity for judgment that I think all citizens need to develop, Arendt, towards the end of her life, helped us try to see what that might look like.
So Arendt made, as you said, a number of major theoretical contributions. You acknowledge in your book that her work on shame is not recognized as one of those principal contributions. What got you interested in how Hannah Arendt thought and wrote about shame?
Well, so as your question quite rightly points out, it is very unusual to talk about Arendt and shame. In fact, her entire political theory, especially The Human Condition, which political theorists take to be the central text of her corpus, that text, or the lesson that she's trying to sort of bring out, is at the very antipode of anything that our sense of shame might, you know, remind us of. To act politically into a community of our equals demands, almost definitionally, that we give up shame, according to Arendt anyway, that we enter the realm of political action unencumbered by feelings of shame or guilt or whatever, because when we act into the world with our equals, what we are basically giving up is any pretense of control. And shame is like an attempt to control in advance the ways in which we might be exposed to our fellow actors. So for me to take up Arendt as a theorist of shame, or certainly draw from her, as I do in the book, some lessons about political shame, is very unusual, to say the least. So I need to sort of justify, and I had to justify for myself, why that's the case. Why can I do this? How can I do this with Arendt? or how I thought Arendt came to be an important resource for thinking about shame. There are two ways for me to answer this. And they both sort of, they came together in a way that was very helpful. The first of which is that despite the fact that The Human Condition is a very important text for Arendt, it's not the only text Arendt wrote. In fact, her, not her dissertation, but her second dissertation, which in Germany you have to write in order to get a teaching position, which she had hoped to get before the Nazis came to power and thereby dashed all possibility of it, was on a German Jewish socialite from the 18th century, about whom we'll talk more, I'm sure, in a bit, Rahel van Hagen. And in that book, shame is a constant companion, a constant theme that Arendt broaches again and again. In The Origins of Totalitarianism, Arendt does not mention shame at all, but I was quite surprised to learn when I was reading her biography, Arendt's biography, that she was never happy with that title, although it seems so natural to us now. It was not, in fact, even a title that she herself chose. It was chosen for her or recommended to her, and she accepted it by her publisher, who thought that she had written something like The Origins of the Species, Darwin's book. And so he gave that title and she accepted it. In Britain, it was not published as that. It was published as The Burden of Our Times, if I remember it correctly. But one of the titles she thought about, and something that I sort of take as instructive, certainly, for my own approach to Arendt, that title was Elements of Shame. In a different universe, what the book that we call The Origins of Totalitarianism could have been called Elements of Shame. The question was, what does she mean by that? What is this idea of shame that she's talking about? And I speak about that at length in my book. But all of this assumes sort of, it requires me to explain something else prior to all of this, which is, why was I looking for shame in the first place? And here, there's a particular way of doing political theory that I am partial to, at least in the writing of this book. It's not the only way of doing political theory. There are lots of different ways of doing political theory, and one learns a lot from all of them. But while I was writing this book, one of the ways in which I thought I wanted to do political theory was to take very seriously Audre Lorde's idea that theory heals. And this, in a sense, that's actually very close to an Arendtian idea, that the ability to be able to tell a story about why you are the way you are, how your life came to be the way it is, by externalizing that experience for yourself, you can gain a handle on it, and you can perhaps move past it, or you can understand the systematic ways in which things that you thought were accidental are part of a larger tapestry that either, you know, liberates you or oppresses you or whatever. And so there was an element of autobiography for me that helped, that made me go looking for shame. And this experience of shame was the experience of, you know, trying to, well, not necessarily assimilate, but certainly belong in the United States. I wasn't born here. I have been living here since I was 18 years old as a student. And it never really seemed to me that I belonged. I always felt like an outsider. And yet that experience of being an outsider was not something that was a very nice experience either to have or even to share with very many people. And in a way, the outsiderness of being an immigrant kind of pushes you into a loneliness where all that you have left with is a certain kind of shame that you can't quite share. And so, you know, I went about looking for ways to understand this shame. One of the people I went to along the way was Frantz Fanon's Black Skin, White Masks, which is a fantastic rumination on the ways in which, you know, shame sort of cripples people's lives. But it was when I read Hannah Arendt's book on Rahel, about whom, as I said, we'll say much more in a bit, that I finally found a way to knit together autobiography and politics and Arendt into one thread. And it's a thread that might be very peculiar to my own experiences, but I think the thing that Arendt helped me see was that my own experiences are in fact experiences shared by many other people around the world.
That's Manu Samnotra. He's assistant professor of political theory in the School of Interdisciplinary Global Studies at the University of South Florida. And we are talking about his new book, Worldly Shame, Ethos in Action. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm C.S. Song. Yeah, let's talk about Rahel van Hagen. As you mentioned, she was a German Jewish socialite. She lived mostly in the 19th century. And she tried to gain access to the highest ranks of non-Jewish, of Gentile society. In fact, she ended up hosting one of the most prominent salons in Europe, during the late 18th and early 19th centuries. And this was the subject, as you mentioned, of a biography that Hannah Arendt wrote of Varnhagen. And this had to do with what you were talking about, the experience of the outsider, right? Many European Jews were outsiders, felt like outsiders, and they sought access to non-Jewish bourgeois society in the 1700s and beyond. So assuming, as we know, that Varnhagen expended a lot of energy trying to assimilate into Gentile society, what did Arendt think of those efforts, of her efforts?
So Arendt writes, well, she says when she finally publishes the book on Rahel Varnhagen in the late 1950s, a book that she's published, I think, almost 20 years after she started writing it. When she finally writes it, she says this book was written, and I'm quoting this from memory, so please forgive me if I'm wrong in some parts of it, but for the most part, paraphrasing, it was written with a knowledge of the doom of German Judaism, which is to say she's writing this after the Holocaust. What it traces is a certain modality of trying to escape the demands of politics, of trying to chart an individual escape route that Rahel Varnhagen thought she could for a while, and many other people did, how that was ultimately unsuccessful. But what that was, what its energies was, what motivated it, what impelled people on a path that, as I mentioned in my book, was ultimately not only unsuccessful for many of them, but even when it was successful, it was just full of so much unhappiness. What made them do this? Now, Arendt writes this book in a way that is perhaps a little unfair to the historical Rahel herself. Scholars who actually are familiar with the salons of Germany and with Rahel Varnhagen and with other figures who populated the scene say that Arendt is not really telling the story of Rahel herself. And I think Arendt at some level accepts that fact, that she is telling the story of Rahel, as she says, as Rahel ought to have told it. This is, again, a paraphrase, but I think a very close one of what Arendt actually says. She tells Rahel's story as Rahel ought to have told it. Had she seen the things that she would later go on to see towards the end of her life, but had seen them throughout, this is how Rahel would have told her life. But what this means is that much of what Rahel lived through, what Arendt recounts in the book, is a story of remaining blind to the life that Rahel herself was living. The experience of being pushed by forces that Rahel did not understand, but which Rahel could not help but obey.
As Arendt saw it, to what extent was shame of Varnhagen's origins, part of Varnhagen's consciousness? And what did, according to Arendt, Varnhagen do with that shame?
I think shame was a very important part of what motivated Rahel. And on which point, just a quick point of clarification, C.S., I will reserve, if we end up talking about him at all, which I don't think we necessarily will, I will reserve the term Varnhagen for the man that Rahel eventually married later on in her life, and he was supposed to be the ticket into the society that she wanted to be part of for much of her existence. But I will refer to her as Rahel. So what role did shame play in Rahel's life? Well, according to Arendt, it was everything. Now, just to be sort of clear on a different point, Arendt has this tripartite distinction that she has between the pariah, the parvenu, and the conscious pariah. The pariahs were people who had no hope of ever being allowed into Gentile society. They were the poorer Eastern Jews who were excluded from all social and political life in Germany. Now, the parvenu, however, is a figure that we're very familiar with, and the Jewish parvenu in particular that Arendt writes about both here and in her Origins of Totalitarianism is a figure that is always trying to gain access into Gentile society, whether through wealth, whether through cultural or, you know, scientific accomplishments. This person wants to be allowed into Gentile society. But as a result, the experience of the parvenu is always the experience of an individual. You only assimilate as a parvenu if you assimilate as an individual, because your accomplishments are yours and yours alone. You don't enter into Gentile society as a people. So therefore, assimilation becomes a very lonely experience. Your shame, the fact that you are not allowed into the society, but the society is a society by which you measure your own accomplishments, that shame is an integral part of what motivates the parvenu. And to the extent that Rahel remains for much of her life a parvenu, this shame is always there with her. It's an intimate partner. She dreams about, or has nightmares about, her shame. And so for Arendt, shame is a central category in the parvenu's life. The shame of not belonging, and the shame, therefore, of wanting to belong.
So then what does Rahel do with her shame? She could wallow in it. She could be paralyzed by it. What alternative avenue does Rahel take that you found interesting, as, of course, related by Hannah Arendt in her biography of Rahel?
So the argument that I make in the book is that, and this is why, you know, I'm so fascinated with shame, is that what Rahel ends up doing with shame through her life is not that she gets rid of shame. I don't think she ever gives up her shame. But she discovers within her shame a different possibility. She lives much of her life trying to run away from her shame, what I call a shame aversion. But the weird thing about that shame aversion is that she's always extremely aware of the ways in which shame impinges on her sense of self. She always feels herself broken, incomplete, unlovable, perhaps, because she thinks she's tainted by her shame. But towards the end of her life, what she does with that shame is something completely different. She embraces it, or at least the version that Arendt wants to tell of Rahel. She embraces her shame. She doesn't so much wallow in it as she takes it as an acknowledgement of the fact that the project that she had been embarking on for the entirety of her life was a fool's errand. That the desire to assimilate was wrong-headed. Because one never assimilates as a people, as I mentioned earlier. One only assimilates as an individual, and the experience of assimilation, even if it succeeded towards the end of her life, it only pushed her further into the loneliness that she felt as an individual. So I'll give you an example from Arendt's book. So for much of her life, she's been ashamed. But towards the end of her life, Arendt says, Rahel goes to visit some of her poorer relatives. And when she goes there, she is welcomed like a grand, this is Arendt's terms, grand, an old sultan has been, you know, welcomed home. And you know, they are fawning over her, they are so impressed with her. Because at some level, the way Rahel reads her relatives' reaction to her, it's almost as if they hope that she can somehow open doors for them. The very doors that are shut for her, they are now turning to her to open them for her. And for the first time in her life, Rahel becomes aware of her shame. Not the shame she felt in front of the people she wanted to join, but the shame she felt in front of people she had been implicitly trying to distance herself from for the entirety of her life. And this is what Arendt says in the book. She says, quote, "To be ashamed of such feelings of condescension," this is towards her poorer co-religionists, "which after all still expressed a sense of affiliation, meant cutting oneself off altogether from all origins, all consolations, all compensations. In expressing her shame, in thrusting from her sense of affiliation, Rahel was giving up far more than she guessed. Not only affiliation to the dark mass of the people, but also the far more necessary solidarity with the tiny group of Prussian exception Jews from whom she sprang and whose destiny she shared. No baptism, no assimilation, no marriage into wealth and nobility could have had so radical an effect as this shame of hers." So I know that it's a little complex, but the basic idea is, here is someone who has spent her entire life trying to somehow get into the upper echelons of society. She's tried to get married, she's tried to assimilate, she's tried to be baptized. She's done everything one can do. And none of it has any effect. None of it really changes the malaise she feels, because nothing really wipes away the stain that she thinks she's carrying with her. But the shame of feeling ashamed before people she thought she should be ashamed of, that transformation in shame is a tremendously radical break. After this point, Rahel says, you know what? What have I been doing with my entire life so far? This is completely nonsensical. And so the people she'd been running away from, she becomes, you know, their friend. She becomes their ally. She becomes the ally, for instance, of the poet Heinrich Heine, who perhaps in a different age she may have run away from because she might have thought, oh my goodness, I don't want to be associated with somebody else who is, you know, who doesn't hew to respectable society's norms and standards. She embraces people like that. And so what happens to her shame is not so much that she stops living with shame. She just learns to feel shame in front of a plurality of perspectives, not just the one perspective that she was interested in being looked at from, but the perspectives that until then she has thought were disreputable, non-respectable, or what have you. And that's what changes. It's not that shame goes away, shame becomes more receptive to more viewpoints.
Manu Samnotra is my guest. He's author of Worldly Shame, Ethos in Action. It's published by Lexington Books. We'll take a short break and speak more with Manu about his very interesting book. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Manu Samnotra joins me. His last name is spelled S-A-M-N-O-T-R-A. He's assistant professor of political theory in the School of Interdisciplinary Global Studies at the University of South Florida. He wrote an article called Sensitive to Shame, Hannah Arendt on Becoming Worldly, that was published in the journal Constellations. And he turned that article, he expanded it quite a bit and moved beyond it in his book, his new book, Worldly Shame, Ethos in Action. I see. So Rahel, she begins to consciously align herself with people she looked askance at earlier, poor, uneducated Jews. And here we get to, I think, the connection you're trying to make in your book, and you use Rahel as one illustration. There are many more, but one illustration of this connection, or one gesture toward this connection, and that is the connection between shame and politics. You are, as I understand it, trying to ascribe a political role to shame in your book, Worldly Shame. So what can we learn? What did you learn from the Rahel Van Hagen biography by Hannah Arendt about the degree to which shame can be, in some sense, mobilized toward political ends?
So the thing that I learned from Arendt's reading of Rahel's shame was that, I mean, at some level, she diagnoses something that's very true about the human experience. I experienced it through my particular, journey as a foreigner living in the U.S. for 2 decades. Other people experience it in other ways. And that experience is the desire to belong, the desire to be welcomed into a community, to find shelter somewhere. And all of that sounds lovely, and we should all want that. But sometimes, in order to get that, we compromise ourselves to things that perhaps we should not compromise ourselves to. We look askance at people that perhaps we should associate more with. We distance ourselves from ways of living that might actually give us a lot of joy. Now, I don't think that the politics that comes out of this particular reading of shame is something that we can, turn to state legislatures or Congress about and say, hey, why don't you cultivate in people a deeper capacity to experience shame at their earlier shame at the people they were feeling ashamed of? I don't even know what that would sound like. It's quite a mouthful just saying it right now. But from a psychological perspective, I think it teaches us something that is important, that is very often lost in the ways in which we think about politics, about the role of the individual in politics. A lot of what our life in the US is structured around is about becoming more secure in ourselves as we go through life. So, you know, getting a good credit score, buying a nice house, having a nice job, you know, I don't know, sending your children to the right sorts of schools, driving the right kind of car. These are impulses and desires that I think a lot of people have. I mean, consumer society would fall apart, for instance, if people didn't have this desire. And the work of advertising companies is to stoke this desire. In this way, the politics that emerges implicitly from living a life of shame, or shame aversion, as I called it, is a life that is promoting implicitly massive income inequalities, promoting environmental degradation, global inequalities, wars, resource extraction at an unsustainable pace. It's a terrible way to be, I think.
And it strikes me as a deeply apolitical way to be.
Yes, absolutely, because what it pushes you again and again into your loneliness. Politics is something that occurs between people, amongst people. But this sense of power that you gain from trying to chase your dream as an individual pushes you into your own loneliness, individual loneliness. The kind of shame that I think Arendt sees Rahel as learning later in life, the effect of that is very counterintuitive. But it's almost like, you know, emptying out a glass that was full of nonsense and creating space for something better. It teaches Rahel her own powerlessness. It teaches Rahel her own inability over the course of her life to get the things she wanted purely as an exertion of her will. It teaches her that at the end of the day, she ultimately depends upon the perspective of other people and to learn to appreciate and account for more perspectives, more people, allows her to discover a different kind of power, the power of refusing this desire to belong, to not accept it as a fact of her life that she must assimilate or her life has no meaning. Rather than go down that path, Rahel is able to learn through her shame that she doesn't have to do that. She can say no to that. And that, the power of saying no, the power of refusing, the power of what I call in the book, the I cannot, is also its own kind of power. And I think it is a prelude to politics. So shame itself, I argue in the book, cannot lead us to a politics. I think the people who read Arendt as being antithetical to shame are absolutely right about this. If shame were to become the substance of politics, I think that would not be a good thing. But shame can lead us towards politics. It can open the door towards politics. It can revivify our awareness of what politics can do. It can make us aware of the need to cooperate with other people, to live lives of solidarity with other people.
Yeah, and here I think it's appropriate, it makes sense to bring up a word that you bring up and elaborate on in your book, Worldly Shame. I'm speaking with Manu Samnotra, and that is worldliness. So this is about becoming worldly or acquiring a sense of worldliness. How do you define worldliness?
I think there's a more formal definition of the term that I will get to in a moment. But I want to take a step back and say something about shame, which, you know, so far I've been talking about it largely in a very positive sense, except for when I talk about shame aversion, I'm talking about this other thing that I call shame proneness, which I argue in the book is a very good thing. But I want to step back for a moment. We are recording this interview on January 7th, 2021. For those of your listeners who are keeping up with the news, interesting things are happening and just happened yesterday. Shocking things happened just yesterday in Washington, D.C. Our impulse, the impulse of many people who are repulsed by what they're seeing, is to say that what happened in Washington, D.C. yesterday when supporters of a certain person stormed the Capitol building, entered the rotunda. The impulse of certain people, of right-minded people, I think we would agree, is that this was shameful. This has tarnished the reputation of the United States around the globe. It is disgusting. It is horrific. It is shameful. And indeed, there are people, commentators right now, who are using just this language. The trouble, however, is that the people that we disagree with politically also use the language of shame. And that is in some ways troubling, right? Because we think we've done something really grand by saying you should be ashamed of yourself. And then the person who we just try to shame turns around to us and says, no, you should be ashamed of yourselves. And this mutability, this flexibility within shame, which is supposed to be a moral term, is deeply troubling. Now, in political theory and in philosophy, people have gone in one of two ways. There are those who say, ah, yeah, but you see, there are moral conceptions of shame and immoral conceptions of shame, and let's try and figure out which is moral and which is immoral. And I quite like that. I really do like the way thinkers have tried to figure out different ways of conceptualizing shame. The other road that people have taken is to say, look, you're never going to be able to remove the sense of domination, the sense of belittlement that shame carries with it. And look, people who you think should be totally ashamed of their conduct are in fact using the language of shame against you. What good is that language doing for you? These people say, let's get rid of the entire sort of edifice of shame as a moral category. Let's think of political life or philosophical language that does not resort to this stuff. Now, it would be foolhardy of anybody who wants to defend shame to take this latter view and say, I don't think there's anything going on there. There's plenty going on there in that view. Shame is used to dominate people. Shame is used to belittle people. Shame is used to harm people every day. We must find a way of grappling with this shame, this bad side of shame. And I don't think you can separate out the good and the bad, even though I would want to, as easily as politics would allow. So we need a different way of thinking about the fact that shame is an integral part of the way in which human beings experience the world. It's a part of how political actors deploy political language against their opponents. And we must try and find a way of using it for better ends. And so the end that I recommend in this book is that we should look at it from the perspective of worldliness. Now, worldliness is almost like a metric by which we say, okay, something works, something doesn't work. If something makes the world, makes us more worldly, good. If something makes us less worldly, not so good. And the concept of worldliness I draw primarily from Arendt, who herself gets it from her teacher, Martin Heidegger, but I also get it from people like Edward Said, who talk about worldliness, or the worldliness of a text. And my general understanding of worldliness is as follows. I write in the book that, quote, the world is a horizon of meaning that is hemmed in by the durable structures that are created and maintained by plural others. These structures do not always pre-exist the efforts of those who make them, and even when they do, as in the form of narratives and historical traditions, they are given new meaning by the actors charged with using and preserving them. Because each actor can bring their own unique perspective to bear on events that occur in the world is marked by its plurality. And this is the important part. Worldliness is that orientation that gives the means, motivation, and direction to our engagement with these structures in a manner that makes them responsive to plural others. The basic gist is this. We live in a world that is shaped by other people, and we share the world with them, and worldliness is the orientation that allows us to take care of structures that help bring these others into the public sphere. To put it a different way, when shame can be used to bring people into political life, that's a good thing. When it's used to push people away from political life, that's a bad thing. When shame is used to create structures that can support the voices of different people from finding, you know, space in our conversations, that's a good thing. When shame is used to demolish those structures, that's a bad thing. So worldliness is the metric by which we should try to figure out politically whether shame is, and I don't like this phrase, but I'll use it anyway, good or bad. So that's what I mean by worldliness. And to become more worldliness is to become more attuned to the ways in which these structures are created and maintained by other people and what we can do to actually enhance those structures.
That's Manu Samnotra. He teaches political theory at the University of South Florida. We are talking about his new book, Worldly Shame, Ethos in Action. We have a link to that book on our website, againstthegrain.org. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. There's an article that Hannah Arendt wrote in 1944 about a 17-year-old girl named Betty, who joined a military operation to liberate the Vilna ghetto in Lithuania. So what did Arendt stress about Betty and about her motivation to do what she did, to risk her life to try and save lives?
So this example of Betty is interesting for two reasons. One is simply how it's, you know, we all have our blind spots. And Arendt's blind spot towards certain issues later in her life is pretty stark and should not go without some mention on my part. So later in life, when Arendt is now, you know, in the United States, she is a citizen of the United States. She's been living here for several years. And, you know, she's an insightful commentator on many things, but she has one major blind spot, which is race relations in the U.S. And especially when she reads about the ways in which the writings of Frantz Fanon have been interpreted by student movements in the U.S., by black activists in the U.S., she basically writes this essay saying violence is the very antithesis of politics. And so for this later Arendt, or the students of Arendt who read her words later in life about the role of violence, for them to discover this article that she wrote during the Second World War about Betty, it's an interesting encounter. Certainly for me it was, to discover Arendt extolling the very things that later on in her life she basically says, maybe not so good. That's one reason. But the other reason why Betty is important is because it's the ways in which Arendt, the thinker, is calling that public into being and how exactly she's using shame to do this. So Betty is, Arendt reads this article about this girl named Betty, as you mentioned, and in the article, they basically sort of say that she was part of a group of young girls who were being trained to fight, as basically an underground resistance army to fight the Nazi occupation.
Was Betty Jewish, and was she Lithuanian, or was she German?
I think from the article, at least the way that Arendt sort of constructs it, she is Jewish. But in some ways, it doesn't really matter for Arendt's purposes. What Arendt wants to show is that what Betty represents is the act of resistance, and the act of even violent resistance, the act of violently throwing off one's shame. Shame aversion, weirdly in this case, is actually a good thing. And Betty's shame aversion is an invitation, according to Arendt, to her readers to become more shame prone.
And so what was Betty ashamed of specifically?
That's the interesting thing. I don't think Betty talks about her shame at all. It's Arendt reading Betty who imputes shame to Betty. So the actual words from Betty, I believe, are, these are the words, "Those who lived in the ghetto," Betty says, "became the real avengers. I killed only 6 Germans, but there are Jews in our unit who have killed dozens." So Betty basically recounts in the article, and this is Arendt, of course, telling the whole story, recounts in the article how when the Germans first came in, people were basically led without any resistance to the camps. But ultimately, some people started standing up and, you know, started sort of pushing back. Betty herself has only killed 6 Germans, but there are others, Jews, in her unit who have killed dozens. And Arendt says, this is Arendt now, quote, "Betty," so she, this is Betty, "is ashamed even to think of how one single German could with impunity lead 60 Jews into slavery and presumably death.
With 6 shots, she expunged the shame of those victims, those defenseless and docile victims. She did not give her name, her last name, to the correspondent for fear of being unduly praised. End quote. Now, Betty herself doesn't talk about her shame. Arendt does. And in the process, what Arendt does is that she invokes this very Greek notion, ancient Greek notion of shame, in order to basically call out her audience. So this is how it works. So the ancient Greek concept is simply, I will completely butcher the pronunciation, I apologize for that, but it's aiodos nemestos, if I'm doing it correctly, I probably am not, but Achilles is aiodos nemestos, someone who is very mindful of his shame and is very careful about any dishonor to his sense of shame. So the idea here is that the moment you feel attacked in your honor, the first thing you must do is you must fight it off. And Arendt is saying, be like Betty. Betty is like Achilles. The moment someone tries to shame Betty by leading 60 Jews to their slavery and presumably death, she hits back. And with 6 shots of a revolver, she has expunged the shame of those victims, those defenseless and docile victims. I'm quoting Arendt. So be like Achilles. But what she's also doing at the same time to her readers is saying, hey, look at this. These are girls. And I think that's the implicit sort of language that Arendt is playing with. These are girls. You claim to be men. What are you doing? Right, so she's in a way using the very gendered language here to basically call out the manliness or the lack of her readers and saying to them effectively, hey, this is what you should be doing. They over there, people like Betty, are doing this over there. And they have much fewer resources than you do. You should be using your resources to make something great happen.
Yeah, it's almost like Arendt is shaming her audience, her readers, the readers she's trying to spur to action, which brings up another point, and it's not a primary point, I think, of your book, Worldly Shame, because we're focusing mostly, I think, on shame as, you know, I'm ashamed of my actions or the actions of others, or I'm ashamed of my origins, you know. Varnhagen might have been ashamed of her Jewish origins. But this question of shaming people into doing the right thing, in the sense of today, we as a political strategy, some of us like to think that shaming someone in relation to something they've done in order to get them to correct their behavior or maybe just to castigate them in a more forceful way. Shaming someone is an important and a good and an effective thing to do. What is your take on that?
The ways in which Arendt uses shame is to call a public into being. She doesn't say then that in this public space, we should deal with the issues that we feel shame about. So let me find this quote for you that I thought was quite wonderful. This is again Arendt writing at the end of the Second World War. And so, you know, at the end of the war, by the way, there are plenty of Germans who are in denial of what happened. Plenty of Germans who say, well, I had no role to play in this. But there are also Germans who are overwhelmed with feelings of guilt, which, by the way, for the sake of my argument, I treat very separately from shame. So this is what Arendt writes. She says, quote, "For many years now, we have met Germans who declare that they are ashamed of being German. I've often felt tempted to answer that I am ashamed of being human. This elemental shame, which many people of the most various nationalities share with one another today, is what finally is left of our sense of international solidarity, and it has not yet found an adequate political expression." So what Arendt says about shame here is that it's the remainder of what was once a sense of solidarity that, you know, the opponents to the Nazis felt amongst each other. The events following the end of the war, basically the advent of the Cold War, for instance, did away with the sense of international solidarity. But a sense of shame remains. The sense of shame is not political, she says. We cannot make a politics out of this. When you try to make a politics out of this, you are determining in advance what people should be talking about, which, as I said earlier, is the very antithesis of what freedom means according to her. But what the shame does remind us of is the desire, is the need for a space of politics. So without going too much into abstractions here, this is where I am in my thinking right now. I'm happy to change my thinking later, but this is where I find myself stuck in ways that are productive and ways that are unproductive. If shame can be used to bring people into politics, to bring them into the political realm, that's a good thing. But if shame is used to determine in advance what people, when they enter politics, should talk about, that is problematic. Because then you are taking away from politics that feature of politics that is its, according to Arendt, its greatest gift, the element of freedom. You are determining in advance what politics can be about. So I don't think we should shame others in the way of making them wear, you know, signs on across their chests and having them walk down the major streets of major cities declaring their crimes. But I think to say to someone, hey, that's not right, we should let other people into the conversation, we should expand the conversation to include other people, more people, I think that's actually a good thing. In those instances, when shame makes us more worldly, shame is working well.
Manu Samnotra, again, Samnotra. His first name is spelled Manu. He teaches political theory in the School of Interdisciplinary Global Studies at the University of South Florida. And on againstthegrain.org, we've put a link both to his faculty page at USF and to his new book, Worldly Shame, Ethos in Action. Manu, congratulations on this book, and thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, CS. It was lovely to talk to you again.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, as Albert Einstein once said, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.